Talk 580 KMJ presents Hometown Heroes, honoring the men and women whose service and sacrifice have secured our freedom. Now, the host of Hometown Heroes, Paul Leffler.
Welcome to another edition of Hometown Heroes, with you every Saturday afternoon here on News Talk 580 KMJ and online at kmjnow.com. If you listen to the program, you know that each week we visit with veterans of World War II. The idea behind that name, Hometown Heroes, is that no matter where you live in this great country of ours, there's a hero, at least one, if not two or 20, in your hometown. I'm talking about men or women who are willing to put their lives on the line for the sake of our freedom, as more than 16 million Americans did during World War II. One of them will be our guest today. And, you know, last week we visited with a soldier who was part of the Lost Battalion rescued by the 442nd Regimental Combat Team. If you know the history of the 442nd, you know that it eventually became part of the 34th Infantry Division. And we'll talk to a veteran of the 34th Infantry Division today. They were known as the Red Bulls. If you thought the energy drink came up with that name, you're a little late, because that nickname's been around a long time. And let's talk to a veteran of that Red Bull Division, Donald Weiss of Walnut Creek, California. He's going to be 90 years old in June. So I'm going to test that memory a little bit for you here, Mr. Weiss. Let's go back to why you got into the service, because you're one of the few guys I talked to who were actually in uniform before Pearl Harbor. Why did you join the Army back in 1941?
Well, I was in the National Guard. All the young kids in our town, it was a chance to earn $7 a night on Monday night, and we'd go to summer camp for 2 weeks, and that was our spending money.
And this is Hartley, Iowa, all of about 1,500 people. Do I have that right?
Exactly right.
So joining the National Guard gave you something to do.
Well, and spending money. that was an important thing back in those days.
And I'm sure it was working out exactly how you wanted it to for a while. But
yes, it did until February 10th, 1941.
What happened on that day?
That was the day that the National Guard was inducted into federal service.
And this was the National Guard in Iowa, and I guess you would join guardsmen from Minnesota and the Dakotas?
Minnesota and South Dakota.
Mm-hmm. To form the 34th Infantry Division.
Right.
What do you remember about a little later that year, I guess about 10 months after that, December 7th, 1941? Where were you that day?
We were in Camp Claiborne, Louisiana. In fact, just got out of my bunk about 10 o'clock that morning and went to the mess hall, and already was blaring that Pearl Harbor was attacked.
Did that register for you? Did it mean anything to you right away?
Well, yes, it did. When they said that the battleships were sunk and everything, and ships were being sunk, and airplanes were flying all over, we knew that was the start of something big.
And you would be a part of the start of something that became big. Your division was the first one sent to Europe, correct?
We were selected by the 34th Division made a good showing in what they call the big maneuvers of Louisiana. And the 34th Division made a good serving, so we were selected by the War Department to be the first division to go overseas.
So just a little bit more than a month after Pearl Harbor was attacked, you guys were sailing out from New York, right?
The afternoon that Pearl Harbor was attacked, we broke camp at Camp Claiborne. I went to New Orleans, Louisiana. The following day, we were on Lake Pontchartrain when President Roosevelt gave his famous speech. And that day, we went from Lake Pontchartrain to Port Sulphur, Louisiana, where there was a Japanese settlement down there. They didn't know exactly how they were going to react. So we spent two or three days down at Port Sulphur at the sulfur mines.
Now, I'm curious, when you talk about being at Lake Pontchartrain the day after the Pearl Harbor attacks, when FDR gave his now famous Day of Infamy speech, were you guys allowed to stop what you were doing and listen to all of that address?
Yes, we were. We were camped out that night there. When we camped out that day, we heard the whole speech.
What did that do for you? Was that a motivational situation for
you? Yes, it was. I mean, we weren't gung ho, but we knew what was in store for us.
Well, and I'm sure this was a pretty significant change for you. Here you had gotten into the National Guard thinking you're going to have some spending money, and now you're wondering if you're going to survive a war that's just starting and has no end date.
Well, so that was true. We didn't know what was in store for us, but we had an idea that we were going to be part of it.
And so many veterans that I've spoken to, you know, signed up because of Pearl Harbor, because of the motivation to strike back at an enemy that had made that surprise attack against the United States. Here you are in the service already, and where they had to wait and wait and wait to actually go over and do something, you might have wished that you could have waited a little longer.
Well, the way it turned out, I mean, I was thankful the way the things happened.
So how long was it from Louisiana till you were on that ship and heading across?
We were on January 1st, we were on our way to Fort Dix by train.
And then I guess about by mid-January you were shipping out?
Yes, yes.
What was the mood on that ship as all these young soldiers, and maybe you had some older soldiers with you too from that National Guard outfit, but how would you describe the morale, the mood of that ship, not knowing what you guys were going to get into?
Well, we were young. We had no idea what we could get into. The mood was good. I mean, we weren't gung-ho or anything like that, but the mood was good.
Now, at that time, you guys had no idea how long this was going to go, but now we can look back and say that your division, the 34th Infantry Division, has the record for the most days of frontline combat.
We had over 516 days of active combat.
And you were there throughout?
I was wounded. I was in the hospital for about a month.
Mm-hmm.
Then I was back on the front lines again.
So when we talk throughout this program about the history of the 34th Infantry Division in World War II, most of it is going to be operations that you had at least some role in, other than while you were injured.
Right, exactly right.
Tell me about where you ended up when you got across the ocean. Where did you land, and what did they do with you from there?
We landed in North Ireland. It was a matter of training and conditioning. We hit every peat bog in North Ireland on our maneuvers and training.
And did that start to get monotonous for you, or?
Yes, it did. It did. Although we had weekend passes, we'd go to dances in these small towns in North Ireland, spend the weekend away from our camp.
And somewhere along that line, you celebrated your 21st birthday overseas.
I guess I did, but I don't remember it.
Well, I won't ask any follow-up questions then. I won't get you in trouble. But by November of 1942, you mentioned that the 34th Infantry was the first division sent overseas, deployed for combat operations in World War II in terms of the European theater of war. And your first combat, I believe, came in North Africa in November of 42, correct?
Yes.
What did that consist of? What do you remember about that first taste?
Our first combats we were in defensive positions. I mean, the Germans were spinning out small patrols and stuff, maybe a couple, two or three light tanks and a couple of platoons of infantry. And it was our job then to knock these patrols out. So we were strictly defensive position.
And what was your specific duty in terms of the unit that you were with?
I was in the weapons platoon of Company I, 133rd Infantry. A weapons platoon, we had three light 60mm mortars and two 30-caliber machine guns. And I was a corporal in the mortar squad.
Did you ever feel like that made you a bit of a target?
The machine guns, yes. Later on, when we got attacking, our mortars were small, 60mm mortars. They didn't do too much damage, but we did quite a bit of damage with our 30-caliber machine guns.
And here you are, half a world away. I imagine North Africa is a little bit different than Hartley, Iowa.
Yeah, a lot of desert and a lot of mountains. Always one, just like Italy, one hill after another.
Was it difficult for you in those first few days to just try to acclimate to the idea that here you are at war, that there are people trying to kill you?
Our first major major contact was with the Battle of Fondouk. All the officers and non-coms had a meeting the night before and tell us what was in store for us at the Battle of Fondouk. Anyway, we got up at 2 o'clock in the morning to have breakfast. The service company is supposed to pick us up at 5 o'clock to take us to our jump-off point. Well, the trucks got lost. And anyway, we didn't reach our destination until about 7 o'clock. And then it was postponed because after the artillery barrage, the airplanes are supposed to come over and drop bombs, which on the targets, and the airborne airplanes never came, so we didn't jump off till 9 o'clock in the morning, daylight, marching 5 miles, open terrain, Germans built in machine guns, artillery, tanks built in, and cement bunkers and everything, and we were caught out in the open.
That sounds just a little bit unnerving.
Well, it was. It was. We were pinned down all day, and maybe about 3 o'clock in the afternoon, some British tanks came on attack, and they stopped right by our foxholes, and we hollered, "Get it, go, 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 go." We didn't want any tanks around our foxholes to draw any more artillery than what we already had.
Mm-hmm. And I bet that seemed like it lasted forever.
It did, yeah. We were pinned down all day and all night. The next day, we were ordered to make another attack, and we know no more and get started, and all hell will break loose again. So about mid afternoon, there's an order came down, and anyway, our battalion commander refused the attack, and of course he was relieved. So that attack was called off until another attack was planned for at night.
What's going through your mind this whole time?
I don't know. We were on British rations, and I know they had a tin of cigarettes they called Craven A. And if I remember correctly, I think there was 50 cigarettes in that little tin thing. I know the time I left Fondouk, I didn't have any cigarettes left. It was all gone. and I wasn't a heavy smoker until then.
I could see how that would do it to you. When you finally got through that action, was there a sense of relief, a sense of accomplishment, or a sense of, wow, if this is what it's all about, this is going to be a long, tough road that we're hoeing here?
Well, yeah, that we thought about that, but that night, a night attack was planned. And this is the Army. A night attack was planned. They walked in. Very few shots were fired because the Germans had started to withdraw other machine gun emplacements. So, of course, the headlines the next day was big attack. American drives Germans out of position. Well, the Germans were leaving. I mean, we did very little that night.
But that was just fine by you.
Yes, exactly right.
So you would move on from North Africa, as folks who know their World War II history, of course, know, and move on to Italy.
Yeah. Well, getting back to North Africa.
Sure.
The big battle was Hill 609.
Uh-huh.
It was near Tunis, and the 133rd Infantry, which is mostly Iowa, and the 135th Infantry was mostly Minnesota, had the job of clearing 609. So about after 2 days and two nights of heavy fighting, a lot of artillery injuries, guys had to be evacuated, and when we finally captured 609, which allowed the Americans, the Germans surrendered, and then we took thousands of prisoners. That was the main battle of North Africa.
Yeah, that was a crucial victory for the Americans. 1st of May, 1943, when it wrapped up. So you talk about the casualties. Is this a situation where guys are falling at your left and your right, and you're trying to figure out if you're going to make it through?
Well, you always thought about that, but you didn't think about it too much. I mean, you know, you had a job to do, and you just went ahead and did it, you know.
And did you realize at the time how significant that victory at Hill 609 was?
Yes, we did. Before that, our 68th Regiment was almost knocked out by Rommel's tanks. Anyway, the 34th Division they called us Green Troops, you know. Well, we might have been Green Troops, but one day we was under British control, the next day we're under French control, the next day we'd be on Second Corps control. So it was just a matter of nobody knew what anybody else was doing.
Just trying to survive, huh?
Trying to survive. But anyway, we got to the thing that we were Green Troops.
Well, I don't think anyone's calling you Green Troops anymore.
No,
and not through the rest of the war, certainly, with more than 500 days of frontline combat. We're talking to Donald Weiss. He served with the 34th Infantry Division in World War II, a division that saw more days of frontline combat than any other infantry division in World War II, the Red Bulls, and he's proud to be one of them. We're going to hear more of his experiences when Hometown Heroes continues next here on News Talk 580 KMJ.
This is Hometown Heroes, honoring everyday Americans who answer the call of duty on 580 KMJ.
Welcome back to Hometown Heroes. We'll continue now with Donald Weiss of Walnut Creek, California, a veteran of the Red Bull Division, the 34th Infantry Division in World War II. And I alluded earlier to another distinction that division holds. Mr. Weiss, at the end of your time in North Africa, you guys got word that the War Department had selected your division for a very significant distinction, at least in retrospect it is. What do you remember about that? I guess it was never good news when you heard the War Department has selected you.
Exactly right.
They told you that your 2nd Battalion would be the Japanese-American soldiers, the gopher-broke soldiers?
Yes.
Part of the 100th, and of course we know the 442nd Regiment was that gopher-broke unit. In fact, we discussed that last week on this program.
Yeah, they came later on. The 100th Battalion joined the 442nd, but one thing they kept their Red Bull shoulder patch. They wouldn't give that up. They wanted to keep that.
So they told you guys that you were going to be joined by this 100th Battalion.
Yes.
And these were Japanese American soldiers. I'm curious how they were welcomed into the fold by the rest of you guys, who certainly looked a little different. And of course, when you remembered December 7th, people that looked like they did were the enemy. Was this something that was a difficult transition?
No, we welcomed them with kid love. They were a great fighting machine. There was no resentment at all. The only resentment was that their blood was red, our blood was red, but all the newspapers back home, it was everything that the Japanese American, nothing about the corn-fed boys from Iowa, Minnesota. All the glory went to the Japanese Americans because of what, you know, their parents were interned in these camps, you know. So they deserved the recognition they got.
When you realize that these guys fighting next to you were fighting for a country that, I think in layman's terms, you would say was holding their families captive.
Right.
Was that something that inspired you to see how hard they were fighting in such a extreme situation?
Definitely, yes.
So they joined your division, and you guys went north from North Africa to Italy.
Yes.
And the first major landing there was at Salerno.
Yes.
In September of 1943?
Yes.
What do you remember about that?
The landing was no action at all in our area. Good landing.
So things were going according to plan for a while.
Evidently, yes.
When did that change?
When we started up North Italy, it was one hill after another, one machine gun emplacement after another. Artillery, German tanks, the weather was awful, the cold, the rain.
Sounds like you might have woken up in a wet foxhole a time or two.
Yes, we did. I mean, it was a time for the build-up, you know, for the big show, so to get replaced, we had awful hard to get replacement. In fact, in October and November and part of December, we were on the front lines for 76 days.
With no relief.
In contact with the enemy. And this was done with no winter clothing. I mean, we had no winter clothing. We just had our regular overcoats and stuff like that.
How did you survive? What did you have some tricks to keep warm? Did you huddle up in a foxhole? What'd you do?
Frostbite was a big item. I mean, hundreds and hundreds of guys had frostbite. In fact, I visited a hospital in that winter, and these legs, the guys up there, their legs were black and blue up their knees. In fact, their legs were amputated. So frostbite was a big deal.
How did you avoid it?
I was a good soldier. Clean socks, dry socks. Always had dry socks.
Is that something you learned back in the winters in Iowa?
Something you learn in your basic training, yes.
So keeping your socks dry, you were able to avoid any kind of frozen feet situation.
Right.
As far as the combat on these hills in Italy and you being part of a mortar platoon, did you ever have much of an idea of where your mortar shells were going? What kind of damage you were inflicting?
No. That's what I say. The 60-millimeter mortars were ineffective, you know. I know it was our machine guns that we gave the German the most trouble with.
And I'm sure an incoming shell or two came somewhere in the vicinity of where you were.
Hundreds and hundreds.
What was that like? How do you deal with a situation like that where any moment?
You never get used to it. You never get used to it. And when the artillery is coming over, when you heard a shell gaining speed, that means that thing is going to be pretty close to you. But if the things are just going over and over all the time, I mean, you kind of got used to that. But if they were starting to gain speed, then you wish you'd have dug deeper.
And how deep could you dig when it was cold and winter in Italy?
And those rocks, you couldn't dig very deep. Up in the hill, up in the mountains, you couldn't dig very deep.
Well, you say hundreds and hundreds and hundreds of shells came at you. I know you did eventually receive the Purple Heart, and we'll get to the story of your being wounded. But I imagine there were some other close calls in addition to that that maybe took your breath away. Anything like that stand out in your mind?
Well, entering the town of Benevento on a cold and windy night was going down a street. I think they're probably asphalt or concrete. The machine gun and mortar section is the order of march is the 1st platoon, 2nd platoon, 3rd platoon, and the Western platoon. Well, right behind the Western platoon was K Company, and a shell came in a K Company. As I remember, that shell took, if I remember correctly, I think it was 13 to 14 killed and 35 injured, just one big shell. And that was right behind, it was the first part of kick, I mean, right behind our Western platoon. So that was bad. I mean, the raining, the screaming, medics, you know, it's nerve-wracking.
It sounds like a helpless feeling.
Yes, it is. You're exactly right.
Was there anything that helped you cope with that, whether it was the camaraderie with your fellow soldiers or a personal faith or letters from home, anything that made that a little bit easier to deal with?
Faith. Personal faith.
Where did that come from?
My childhood years. Sunday school, to learn about your Savior. You say your prayers every night. Thanking God for every breath you have.
And sounds like it worked.
Evidently. I still give thanks every day.
I don't blame you. Now, you talked about Benevento, and that was a key point in this advance north through Italy. One of the other battles that is looked back with great respect and with a certain degree of fame.
The Battle of Cassino.
Exactly, with a famous monastery on top of the hill.
Exactly right.
What do you remember about that?
Well, I remember the first time we got in a casino, we got caught out in a minefield, and evidently the minefield was the minefields for tanks, and luckily it wasn't for infantry, so all these tanks were being blown up, but none of us were heavy enough to set off the mine. But we finally got in the casino during the night. We had four or five houses in the casino, and then they counterattacked, and we were driven back out.
And eventually, and I, from what I've read about that battle, And this was, of course, the first battle of Casino. And you guys in the infantry battalion suffered extreme casualties. Losing.
Pardon?
The casualties were extreme in the 34th Infantry Division. I've read as much as 80% of the soldiers in those infantry battalions became casualties.
On the way to Casino, our company never had full strength. The full strength of an infantry company was usually around 100, but time after time we were down to 30 or 40 men in our company. So, yes, a lot of casualties.
Does that make you wonder when your number's going to be called?
You don't think about that.
No good can come of that, huh?
Right, exactly right.
What does it mean to you when you realize, and you guys couldn't quite finish the job at that point in terms of conquering the ground that you were trying to conquer, but I've read that eventually it took 5 entire infantry divisions to do that, and you guys nearly did it on your own as the
34th. Exactly right.
Does that give you pride?
Yes, it does. I mean, we were our company was the last company to leave the casino. We left our houses to go out and watch them bomb the Abbey that day, and wave after wave of bombers came over, and there again, I guess I call a spade, and said the Abbey was knocked out. Well, the Abbey was not knocked out that day. It was knocked out later on. But bomb after bomb after bomb missed the target, the Abbey.
Was that kind of surreal for you to see? Here's this, you talked about your own faith, and here's this Abbey that represents, you know, peace and spirituality, and the enemy is inhabiting it to try to take you out, and now your planes are bombing it. It had to be kind of a strange scene.
Yes, exactly right.
And what do you remember about how that all wrapped up and how you moved on from there?
I guess I'd have to say that the entire battle of Casino was a failure, because we had failed to take it. The Germans had succeeded in blocking everything we could do, but the men who were at Casino and knew the difficulties of the Abbey and the problems house to house fighting. Casino was an outstanding achievement. When the Allies finally achieved their goal of taking Casino, no less than 5 divisions were required to finish the task, which the 34th had begun.
And this is clearly something that's emotional for you, are you?
Very, very, very much so.
Does it make you think of the friends that you lost there?
Yeah, the Battle of Casino, the men in the 1st and 3rd Battalion fought side by side with the 100th Battalion, the Japanese and Americans. The Japanese-Americans had a superb record of courage. It was so incredible that far no more, Hollywood made a movie about the nascent World War II called Gopher Broke.
Gopher Broke, absolutely. And certainly the courage was the same for you and your fellow soldiers in the 133rd Regiment as well. I guess, and I've later heard about the Iron Man Battalion, that some soldiers from your regiment saw more combat than any other regiment, not just your division as a whole, but
right,
for more than
right.
600 days.
Yes.
I want to ask you, and you talked about, you know, eventually Casino being taken, but you went from there, and it seems like maybe this was a never-ending struggle for you and the men in your division. If you survived these battles where so many casualties were claimed, that all you had to look forward to was another battle that was just as vicious. And I believe, and I would imagine, that Anzio was another pretty treacherous time for you as well once you got to March of 1944.
Anzio, I always remember Casino as being the worst that I've seen, but Anzio was a whole different thing. I mean, we had so much limited ground in Anzio. I mean, everything was just packed in, and artillery shells could hit anything at any time. There was no movement during the day in Anzio. I mean, everything had to be done at night, because if you were out in the daylight, you were setting ducks. So everything at Anzio was done at night.
And that had to be a little treacherous and scary for you, trying to move at night too when you can't see what you're doing.
Yeah. All patrols were done at night.
we're talking about all this, and you guys landed in Salerno in September of 43. You fought your way all the way up there that we've talked about in terms of casino. Then you head over at Anzio. You're there in March of 44. So in a six-month period, you're fighting some very major battles. And, you know, there are still people that think the war hadn't even started in Europe yet. You know,
exactly
people think
right.
about D-Day, and that's it. And we're still, you know, 2.5 months ahead of D-Day, and you've already seen half the war.
Well, I think we took Rome on June 6th. I think that was the day of the landing, wasn't it? The big landing.
That's exactly right.
Yeah, that's the day we took Rome on June 6th.
Do you ever feel like you and your fellow soldiers in the 34th and everyone that was participating in this Italian campaign, that maybe your efforts are overlooked because D-Day gets so much attention and the Normandy invasion is such a famous occurrence?
I never did. I was, well, I was just thankful the way it ended up. I mean, I knew they had big battles and, you know, and got a lot of headlines, but no, it didn't bother me a bit.
Well, I know one thing that bothered you a little bit when you got wounded and were taken off the lines. And when we come back, I'm going to get the story of that Purple Heart that Don Wiese can proudly wear today. Donald Wiese, 90 years old this coming June. He's not 90 yet. For now, he's 89, but he's our guest today on Hometown Heroes. And we'll be right back on News Talk 580 KMJ.
On the front line of freedom, you're listening to Hometown Heroes with Paul Leffler on News Talk 580 KMJ.
Welcome back to Hometown Heroes. We're visiting today with Donald Wiese of Walnut Creek, California. He'll be 90 come June, and so many years ago, he was one of the first Americans to participate in the European theater in World War II, part of the 34th Infantry Division. You've heard him talk about North Africa and Italy, and one thing he has not told us yet was how he was wounded, how he came to bear that Purple Heart medal. And we're going to get that story now, and I guess this story goes all the way back to your high school football team in Iowa?
Yes, it does. I have a soldier named Ronnie Kuckel. He and I were the guards in our high school football team when we were both juniors. Well, I was wounded at Cisterna, and Ronnie was killed at Saturna. Ronnie volunteered for the Rangers, and in January, I think, of 44, the Rangers made an attack at Saturna, and the 1st and 3rd Ranger Battalion was ambushed. And as I remember, out of 700-some men, I think only 6 returned. The rest were either killed or captured. Well, Ronnie was killed. Now, Ronnie was a first sergeant in the Ranger Battalion. I was first sergeant at Company I. And Ronnie was killed. I was just wounded day after day. I wondered why.
You wondered why he was killed and you lived?
Yes.
And I think everyone listening understands how that is still so powerful for you. And we know that had Ronnie survived, he would have made something of his life just the way you have. You hit upon something with the Rangers some people don't know. We've talked about your division being the first in so many ways, and it really was the birthplace of the Rangers, too. More than 80% of the Rangers in World War II came out of the 34th Infantry Division. When you talk about Ronnie being killed there at Cisterna, and this was after the Anzio engagement that we talked about as the race toward Rome had begun. Was that something, when you were wounded, that you found out he had been killed then, or was it not till later you learned?
Not until later. I was wounded by artillery. We had just come back from, we were at an outpost. We spent a night at an outpost. We were just coming back at daylight. In fact, we got a late start, and we were... should have been back before daylight, but anyway, we got caught, and we got in an artillery barrage. And I was very lucky. I just got a small piece of shrapnel, just enough to send me back to the hospital for about a month.
Well, if you're in the hospital for a month, it sounds like it's more than just a little bit of shrapnel, or it got you in the right place. Where did it hit you?
In my left hip.
Uh-huh.
I got hit early in the morning, And there again, I mean, any movement during the day was was just like asking for trouble. So I got hit maybe mid-morning, and we had this barn, and we had a tank right beside us. So I knew that tank was going back that night, so I thought rather than have the stretcher bearers, you know, take me out during the daylight, decided that I would stay and go out with that tank that night. Come darkness, they put me on a litter bearer and strapped me on the tank. And the minute that tank started the motor, all hell broke loose. I guess I was scared for every day I was in action. But this, I was never so scared being tied down on this tank, on this litter bearer, and this artillery coming in there, and I had no place to go. I mean, I was helpless. So I guess if I was ever scared, that was the most scared I ever was that night. But finally, we got out of there and take me back to the aid station.
I imagine you had a few thank yous to say to that tank crew.
I sure did.
And probably never prayed as hard in your life either.
Well, I guess I should have prayed a lot more than what I did, but the good Lord has watched over me.
And maybe you questioned your decision to wait for the tank?
Yes.
And, you know, when you said you got hit a little bit, but they had to put you on a litter bearer and get you out of there, it sounds like you couldn't move on your own, so
No, I couldn't.
Your mobility was taken out by that.
Right.
What was it like for you once you did get to the aid station and were moved to a hospital and you're recuperating? What was that month like for you?
The first thing that I remember was white sheets, clean sheets, to be in a bed with sheets. it was like heaven, I guess, you know. But I always remember those clean sheets.
You probably thought you'd never see those again when you're out on a hill in Italy.
Exactly right, yeah.
As time went by, as the days and the weeks passed, and you know you're getting somewhat stronger and you're starting to heal up, were you looking forward to getting back to your fellow soldiers? Were you kind of hoping they might send you home?
I wanted to go home, but the only people that were going home were a lot, you know, worse off shape than I was. One thing I didn't want to do was go back to my company. But I went back to the company just in time for the last big push up Italy. And I wondered then, oh, Lord, why did I have to go back? Just see me and just be with me for maybe another month or 6 weeks until this thing is over with. But the way it turned out, it was all right.
Well, I'm curious, that time that you spent in the hospital, obviously you're not the only wounded soldier there recuperating. Were some of the other soldiers that you saw, did some of those images stick with you? Did you see, and I guess much like your high school football buddy, did you look at them and say, boy, I could be worse off than I am?
Oh, definitely, all the time. And even to this day, I mean, I've been going to the VA hospital up here in Martinez, California, and every day I see that very same thing of, you know, veteran after veteran in worse shape than I am.
So you were good enough in the Army's estimation to get back on the front lines and fight with your unit?
Right. Almost up to the Swiss border.
So this is on into April and May of 1945.
Exactly right, yeah. In fact, the German 34th Division surrendered to our American 34th Division.
That sounds like a memorable day.
And anyway, like our patch of Red Bull, we were given an emblem of the 34th German Division.
Yeah, that had to be strange for you to hear you've been fighting these guys to the death for months and years in your case. And now they were, you probably understood them a little more when you came face-to-face in a situation like that.
Very much so. And anyway, we saw their artillery. They had no vehicles. Their artillery was pulled by horses and everything. So they were a really defeated division.
And did you believe that the war was really over?
I wanted to. Yes. Yeah. Well, we knew then that the war was over for us. Although, I mean, we never thought about Japan, but I guess there would have been that chance that we went to Japan, but we were on a point system, and I had more than enough points to go home, so I was one of the first ones to go home after the war was over.
Would you say that after you came back to the lines, after you were wounded and recuperated, and joined your platoon again, your company again, did you have a different perspective than before your injuries?
No, no, not really. One thing I thought about, well, after going through all of this, now having to go back, will my number really be up, you know?
Mm-hmm.
Before that, I never gave that much thought. I mean, I just, you know, you just go and do what you have to do and don't think about what could happen. But after I went back the second time, yes, I thought, well, golly, is my number going to be up after all this?
And during that whole time, how much contact did you have with anybody back home?
Letters from home, just family.
Did that mean something to you? Did that make a difference?
Oh, definitely. I mean, you couldn't wait to, well, it wasn't May call then. I mean, the mail was brought up with the rations, you know. So sometimes your letters from home was weeks late, you know.
Now, I've read that for your division, the 34th Infantry Division, the casualties for your division are considered the highest of any division in the European theater in terms of daily per capita fighting strength. So in terms of the guys who are actually on the ground, more soldiers were wounded in your division than any other division.
True.
What does that mean to you?
Well, number one, we saw an awful lot of combat. I mean, the combat we saw was the best that the Germans had to offer. I mean, they had their tanks were outstanding. Their artillery was outstanding. The 88 artillery under tanks, like they had seeing eye. I mean, the observers could pick out like a needle in a haystack. So, climbing up these mountains, you're always subject to a lot of artillery. Small arms fire really didn't bother me, because if the first burst of a machine gun or the first bullet from a sniper didn't get me, I figured I was a good enough soldier to get down, to get below the machine gun fire. But artillery had no control over me, and it was just shell after shell after shell. And it hit these rocks in the mountains, and just things would just fly all over. So that was one of the biggest worries that we had.
When you look back now and you realize that you saw more than 500 days of combat, is that hard to believe that you survived all that?
Miraculous. Sometimes the close calls you had was unbelievable. Walking down the street of a town and have a machine gun go right over the top of your helmet and hit the wall, and figured that another 3-4 inches, it could have been right smack bad to your helmet. You wonder why. That showed that the machine gun wasn't 3 inches lower. But you just keep on going. I mean, those things just happen. You just keep on going.
Can you describe the feeling when it finally was over, when you finally did get to come home?
Unbelievable. Unbelievable. Just a sigh of relief. I mean, you get on your knees and you give thanks to the good Lord that he was with you. Even though I knew I was going home, I mean, I couldn't get home fast enough.
I bet.
Yeah.
And I bet you can still remember the look on your family's faces when you got home.
Yes, yes. Very, very. My mother and father, I was one of eight children, or the youngest of eight children, so my mother and father were getting up in age when I got home, but I can remember them. I mean, my mother crying.
I'm curious as well, especially with everything you saw, being in a division that saw more frontline combat than any other division in World War II, being wounded, surviving everything you survived. When you got home, did you feel a different kind of motivation or even a responsibility to do something with this second chance at life that you'd been given?
Well, number one, I was so happy to get home. Number one, I didn't know what I was going to do. You know, I mean, what am I going to do? Here I am. I mean, my clothes were given to me. I didn't have to worry about a place to sleep. I didn't have to worry about any need. So here I am. You know, I'm on my own. You know, I'm kind of lost, really.
And eventually you figured it out.
Evidently. Live to tell the story.
Another question I like to ask the veterans on this show, and maybe some of the listeners get tired of it, but it hits me to the core every time. You ever think about people who wouldn't be here, who never would have been born if you didn't make it home from the war?
Yes, yes. The one thing that bothers me the most about war is War is a game of politics. I mean, there was politics in World War II. I know when we first started action, I mean, there was always that friction between the British and the United States. I mean, Montgomery versus Eisenhower, who was going to... So that was even going through. And then our division, I mean, we were under this control, that control. Nobody knew what they were doing. Those things bothered me.
Sure, understandable. Oh, in closing, when you look back on all of it, when you think about all those days that you spent in that mortar platoon, when you think about all the guys that you knew that didn't come home from the war, what do you think Americans today need to understand about what you and guys like you did and why you were doing it? What would you say you're most proud of?
What I'm most proud of?
Mm-hmm.
My 4 years, 6 months, and 19 days in the Army.
And it probably felt like a lot longer than that.
Not at the time. I have memories of a lot of friendship that I made when I was in a company. Our company had four brothers in the company one time, and my platoon sergeant was one of the brothers, and he was killed at 6:09. I think about that.
Well, I just want to say on behalf of our listeners, thank you for serving our country for those 4 years and 6 months and the days that you talked about. Thank you for telling us a little bit about it. Is there anything else that you want to share with our audience?
No, not really. I mean, I just want to give thanks that the way things turned out, and I hope that your sons and daughters never have to go through anything like we went through. But that's about the size of it.
Amen. Well, hopefully because of the courage, the service, the sacrifice of your generation, future generations won't have to go through that. Well, that is our program for today. 89-year-old Donald Weiss of Walnut Creek, California, a veteran of the 34th Infantry Division, the Red Bulls in World War II, has been our guest. I want to thank Don Thomas of Walnut Creek, who goes to church with Mr. Weiss, and let me know about him. If you have a hometown hero you think I ought to hear about, email me, paul@kmjnow.com. Thanks for listening to Hometown Heroes today on News Talk 580 KMJ.